find the way in, a cave, no admittance except on business. The sea they think they hear, singing, a roar, the blood it is, souse in the ear sometimes, well, it's sea, corpuscular islands. Wonderful, really, so distinct. Again George Lidwell held its murmur, hearing, then laid it by, gently. "What are the wild waves saying?" he asked her, smiled. Charming sea-smiling and unanswering, Lydia on Lidwell smiled. Tap. By Larry O'Rourke's, by Larry, bold Larry O, Boylan swayed, and Boylan turned. From the forsaken shell, Miss Minor glided to her tankard, waiting. No, she was not so lonely, archly, Miss Deuce's head let Mr. Lidwell know. Walks in the moonlight by the sea? No, not alone. With whom? She nobly answered, with a gentleman friend. Bob Cowley's twinkling fingers in the treble played again. The landlord was the prior. A little time, Long John, Big Ben. Lightly he played a light, bright, tinkling measure for tripping ladies, arch and smiling, and for their gallants, gentlemen friends. One, 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 two, one, three, four. Sea, wind, leaves, thunder, waters, cows lowing, the cattle market, cocks, hens don't crow, snakes hiss. There's music everywhere. Rutledge's door, creaking. No, that's noise. Minuet of Don Giovanni he's playing now. Court dresses of all descriptions and castle chambers dancing. Misery, peasants outside, green starving faces eating dock leaves. Nice, that is. Look, 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 look. You look at us. That's joyful, I can feel. Never have written it. Why? My joy is other joy. But both are joys. Yes, joy it must be. Mere fact of music shows you are. Often thought she was in the dumps till she began to lilt. Then no. McCoy Valise, my wife and your wife. Squealing cat. Like tearing silk. When she talks, like the clapper of a bellows. They can't manage men's intervals. Gap in their voices, too. Fill me, I'm warm, dark, open. Molly, in quis est homo, mercadante. My ear against the wall to hear. Want a woman who can deliver the goods. Jog, jig, jogged, stopped. Dandy tan shoe of dandy Boylan socks, sky-blue clocks, came light to earth. Oh, look, we are so... Chamber music. Could make a kind of pun on that. It is a kind of music I often thought when she... Acoustics, that is. Tinkling. Empty vessels make most noise. Because the acoustics, the resonance changes according as the weight of the water is equal to the law of falling water. Like those rhapsodies of Liszt's, Hungarian, gypsy-eyed, pearls drop, rain... Diddle-diddle, addle-addle, oddle-oddle. Is now. Maybe now. Before. One rapped on a door, one tapped with a knock. Did he knock, pulled the cock with a loud, proud knock, with a cock, cutter, 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 cock, cock, cock. Tap. Quistenio, Ben, said Father Cowley. No, Ben, Tom Kernan interfered. The croppy boy, our native Doric. Ah, do, Ben, Mr. Dedalus said. Good men and through. Do, do, they begged in one. I'll go. Here, pass, return. Come. He came. He came. He did not stay. To me. How much? What key? Six sharps? F-sharp major, Ben Dollard said. Bob Cowley's outstretched talons gripped the black, deep-sounding chords. Must go, Prince Bloom told Richie Prince. No, Richie said. Yes, must. Got money somewhere. He's on for a razzle backache spree. Much? He see his lip speech. 1 and 9. Penny for yourself. Here. Give him tuppence tip. Deaf, bothered. But perhaps he has wife and family waiting, waiting Patty come home. He-he-he-he. Deaf wait while they wait. But wait, but hear. Chords dark. Lugugubrious, low. In a cave of the dark middle earth. Embedded ore. Lump music. The voice of dark age, of unlove, earth's fatigue, made grave approach, and painful, come from afar, from hoary mountains, called on good men and true. The priest he sought... With him, would he speak a word? Tap. Ben Dollard's voice, barrel tone. Doing his level best to say it. Croak of vast, manless, moonless, womoonless marsh. Other come down. Big ship's chandler's business he did once. Remember, rosiny ropes, ship's lanterns, failed to the tune of £10,000. Now the ivy home, cubicle number so-and-so. Number one bass did that for him.
The priest at home.
A false priest's servant bade him welcome. Step in. The Holy Father. Curlicues of chords. Ruin them, wreck their lives, then build them cubicles to end their days in. Hushabye, lullaby, die, dog, little dog, die. The voice of warning, solemn warning, told them the youth had entered a lonely hall, told them how solemn fell his footstep there, told them the gloomy chamber, the vested priest, sitting to shrive. Decent soul, bit addled now, thinks he'll win in answers, poet's picture puzzle. We hand you crisp £5 note, bird sitting hatching in a nest, lay of the last minstrel, he thought it was. C blank T. What domestic animal? T-R. Most courageous mariner. Good voice he has still. No eunuch yet, with all his belongings. Listen. Bloom listened. Richie Goulding listened. And by the door, deaf Pat, bald Pat, tipped Pat, listened. The chords harped slower. The voice of penance and of grief came slow, embellished, tremulous. Ben's contrite beard confessed.
In nomine Domini.
In God's name. He knelt. He beat his hand upon his breast, confessing.
Mea culpa.
Latin again. That holds them like bird lime. Priest with a communion corpus for those women. Chap in the mortuary coffin. Or coffee. Corpus nomine. Wonder where that rat is by now. Scrape. Tap. They listened. Tankard and Miss Kennedy. George Lidwell. Eyelid well expressive. Full busted satin. Kernan. Sigh. The sighing voice of sorrow sang. His sins. Since Easter he had cursed 3 times. Your pitcher's pass. And once at mass time he had gone to play. Once by the churchyard he had passed, and for his mother's rest he had not prayed. A boy. A croppy boy. Bronze, listening by the beer pull, gazed far away, soulfully. Doesn't half know I'm Molly, great dab at seeing anyone looking. Bronze gazed far, sideways. Mirror there. Is that best side of her face? They always know. Knock at the door. Last tip to titivate.
Cock-cutter-cutter!
What do they think when they hear music? Way to catch rattlesnakes. Night Michael Gunn gave us the box. Tuning up. Sharp Persia liked that best. Reminder of home sweet home. Wiped his nose and curtain, too. Custom is country, perhaps. That's music, too. Not as bad as it sounds. Tootling. Brass is braying. Asses through up trunks. Double basses. Helpless gashes in their sides. Woodwinds. Mooing cows. Semi-ground open crocodile. Music hath jaws. Woodwind, like Goodwin's name. She looked fine. Her crocus dress she wore, low cut. Belongings on show. Clover breath was always in theatre when she bent to ask a question. Told her what Spinoza says in that book of poor papa's. Hypnotized, listening. Eyes like that. She bent. Chap in dress circle staring down into her with his opera glasses for all he was worth. Beauty of music you must hear twice. Nature, woman, half a look. God made the country, man the tune. Metempsychosis. Philosophy. Oh, rocks. All gone, all fallen. At the siege of Ross, his father. At Gorey, all his brothers fell. To Wexford. We are the boys of Wexford. He would. Last of his name and race. I, too. Last my race. Millie, young student. Well, my fault, perhaps. No son. Rudy. Too late now. Or if still. He bore no hate. Hate, love. Those are names. Rudy. Soon I am old. Big Ben, his voice unfolded. Great voice, Richie Goulding said, a flush struggling in his pale, to bloom, soon old, but when was young. Ireland comes now, my country above the king. She listens, who fears to speak of 1904. Time to be shoving. Looked enough.
Bless me, father,
Dollar the croppy cried.
Bless me and let me go.
Tap. Bloom looked unblessed to go. Got up to kill, an 18-bob week. Fellow, shell out the dibs. Want to keep your weather eye open. Those girls, those lovely. By the sad sea waves. Chorus girls romance. Letters read out for breach of promise. From Chickabiddy's own mumsy pum. Laughter in court. Henry, I never signed it. The lovely name you. Low sank the music, air and words. Then hastened. The false priest, rustling soldier from his cassock. A yeoman captain. They know it all by heart, the thrill they itch for, yeoman cap, tap, tap. Thrilled, she listened, bending in sympathy to hear. Blank face, virgin, should say, or fingered only. Write something on it, page. If not, what becomes of them? Decline, despair. Keeps them young, even admire themselves. See? Play on her, lip blow. Body of white woman, a flute alive, low, gentle, loud. Three holes, all women. Goddess, I didn't see. They want it. Not too much polite. That's why he gets them. Gold in your pocket, brass in your face. With look to look, songs without words. Molly, that hurdy-gurdy boy. She knew he meant the monkey was sick, because so like the Spanish. Understand animals too that way. Solomon did. Gift of nature. Ventriloquize. My lips closed. Think in my stem. What? Will you? I want you to. With hoarse, rude fury, the yeoman cursed. Swelling, an apoplectic bitch's bastard. A good thought, boy, to come. 1 hour's your time to live, your last. Tap, tap. Thrill now. Pity they feel. To wipe away a tear for martyrs, for all things dying, one to dying to die, for all things born. Poor Mrs. Purefoy. Hope she's over. Because their wombs... A liquid of womb of woman eyeball gazed under a fence of lashes, calmly hearing. See real beauty of the eye when she not speaks, on yonder river. At each slow, satiny heaving bosom's wave, her heaving ombom, red rose rose slowly, sank red rose. Heart beats her breath, breath that is life, and all the tiny, tiny fern foils trembled of maiden hair. But look, the bright stars fade. O rose, Castile, the morn. Ha! Lidwell! For him, then, not for... Infatuated, I like that. See her from here, though. Popped corks, splashes of beer froth, stacks of empties. On the smooth, jutting beer pool, laid Lydia hand lightly. Plumply, leave it to my hands. All lost in pity for Croppy. Fro, to, fro, over the polished knob. She knows his eyes, my eyes, her eyes. Her thumb and finger passed in pity, passed, repassed, and gently touching, then slid so smoothly, slowly down, a cool, firm, white enamel baton protruding through their sliding ring. With a cock, with a carrer, tap, tap, tap.
I hold this house. Amen.
He gnashed in fury.
Traitor swing.
The chords consented. Very sad thing, but had to be. Get out before the end. Thanks, that was heavenly. Where's my hat? Pass by her. Can leave the freeman. Letter I have. Suppose she wear the... No. Walk, walk, walk. Like Cashel, Boyle, O'Connor, O'Coyle, O'Tisdall, Morris, Tinstall, Farrell. Walk. Well, I must be... Are you off? Your spies, Bloomstuff. Oh, you're right, I blew. Bloom stood up. Ow. Soap feeling rather sticky behind. Must have sweated. Music. That lotion, remember. Well, so long. High grade. Card inside, yes. By deft pat in the doorway, straining ear, Bloom passed.
At Geneva barrack that young man died, at passage waters his body laid.
Dolore, oh, he dolores, the voice of the mournful chanter called to dolorous prayer. By rose, by satiny bosom, by the fondling hand, by slops, by empties, by popped corks, greeting and going, past eyes and maiden hair, bronze and faint gold in deep sea shadow, went Bloom, soft Bloom. I feel so lonely, Bloom. Tap, tap, tap. Pray for him, prayed the bass of Dollard. You who hear in peace, breathe a prayer, drop a tear, good men, good people. He was the Croppy boy. Scaring eavesdropping boots, Croppy Boots boy Bloom in the almond hallway heard growls and roars of bravo. Fat backslapping, the boots all treading, boots, not the boots, the boy. General chorus off for a swill to wash it down. Glad I avoided.
Come on, Ben,
Simon Dedalus said.
By God, you're as good as ever you were.
Better, said Tom Jim Kernan. Most trenchant rendition of that ballad upon my soul and honour it is.
La blash, said Father Cowley.
Ben Dollard bulkily catchucad towards the bar, mightily praise fed, and all big roseate on heavy-footed feet, his gouty fingers knackering castanets in the air. Big Beneden Dollard, Big Ben Ben, Big Ben Ben, brrr. And deep moved all, Simon trumpet compassion from foghorn nose, all laughing, they brought him forth, Ben Dollard, in right good cheer.
You're looking rubicund, George Lidwell said.
Miss Deuce composed her rose to wait.
"Ben McCree," said Mr. Dedalus, clapping Ben's fat back shoulder-blade. "Fit as a fiddle, only he has a lot of adipoise tissue concealed about his person. Rrrrss! Fat of death,
Simon," Ben Dollard growled. Richie, rift in the lute alone, sat, Goulding Collars Ward, Uncertainly he waited. Unpaid Pat, too. Tap, tap. Tap, tap. Miss Minor Kennedy brought near her lips to ear of Tankard One.
"Mr. Dollard," they murmured low.
"Dollard," murmured Tankard. Tank One believed, Miss Kenwyn she, that doll he was, she-doll, the tank. He murmured that he knew the name. The name was familiar to him, that is to say. That was to say, he had heard the name of Dollard, was it? Dollard, yes.
"Yes," her lips said more loudly, "Mr. Dollard."
"He sang that song lovely," murmured Minor.
"And The Last Rose of Summer was a lovely song."
Minor loved that song. Tankard loved the song, that Minor. "'Tis the last rose of summer, Dollard." Left, Bloom felt wind wound round inside.
"Gassy thing, that cider. Binding, too. Wait, post office near Reuben J's. One and eightpence, too.
Get shot of it. Dodge round by Greek Street.
Wish I hadn't promised to meet. Freer in air. Music gets in your nerves.
Beer pull. Her hand that rocks the cradle rules the Benhove that rules the world.
Far, 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 far. Tap, 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 tap.
Up the quay went Lionel Leopold, Naughty Henry, with letter for Maddie, with sweets of sin, with frillies for Raoul, with metempsychosis, went Poldy on. Tap blind walked tapping by the tap, the curbstone tapping, tap by tap.
Cowley, he stuns himself with it, a kind of drunkenness.
Better give way only halfway, the way of a man with a maid. Instant enthusiasts, all ears, not lose a demi-semi-quaver, eyes shut, head nodding in time.
Dotty, you don't budge. Thinking strictly prohibited. Always talk in shop, fiddle-faddle about notes. All a kind of attempt to talk. Unpleasant when it stops, because you never know exact.
Organ in Gardiner Street. Old Glynn, 50 quid a year.
Queer up there in the cockloft alone, with stops and locks and keys,
seated all day at the organ. Maunder on for hours, talking to himself, or the other fellow blowing the bellows. Growl, angry, then shriek, cursing. Want to have wadding or something in this.
No, don't, she cried.
Then all of a soft sudden, wee little, pippy wind. A wee little wind piped E in Bloom's little wee.
Was he? Mr. Dedalus said, returning with fetch pipe. I was with him this morning at poor little Paddy Dignam's. Aye, the Lord have mercy on him. By the by, there's a tuning fork in there on the...
Tap, 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 tap.
The wife has a fine voice, or had, what?
Lidwell asked.
Oh, that must be the tuner, Lydia said to Simon Lionel first I saw. Forgot it when he was here.
Blind he was, she told George Lidwell second I saw, and played so exquisitely, treat to hear, exquisite contrast, bronze lid, minor gold. Shout, Ben Dollard shouted, pouring. Sing out! It'll do, cried Father Cowley.
Rrrr. I feel I want...
Tap, 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 tap.
Very, Mr. Dedalus said, staring hard at a headless sardine.
Under the sandwich bell lay in a beer of bread one last, one lonely, last sardine of summer. Bloom, alone.
Very, he stared. The law register for choice.
Tap, 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 tap. Bloom went by Barry's.
Wish I could. Wait, that wonder worker if I had. 24 solicitors in that one house. Litigation. Love one another. Piles of parchment. Messrs. Pick and Pocket of Power of Attorney. Goulding Collis Ward. But, for example, the chap that wallops the big drum. His vocation. Mickey Rooney's band. Wonder how it first struck him. Sitting at home after pig's cheek and cabbage, nursing it in the armchair. Rehearsing his band part. Pom. Pompity. Jolly for the wife. Ass's skins.
Welcome through life, then wallop after death.
Pom, wallop. Seems to be what you call yashmak, or I mean kismet, fate.
Tap, tap. A stripling, blind, with a tapping cane, came tap, tap, tapping by Daly's window, where a mermaid, hair all streaming, but he couldn't see, blew whiffs of a mermaid, blind couldn't, mermaid coolest whiff of all.
Instruments, a blade of grass, shell of her hands, then blow. Even comb and tissue paper you can knock a tune out of, Molly in her shift on Lombard Street West. Hair down. I suppose each kind of trade made its own, don't you see? Hunter with a horn, haw. Have you the cloche, sonela?
Shepherdess pipe, policeman a whistle.
Locks and keys, sweep, 4 o'clock, all's well. Sleep. All is lost now. Drum, pompity. Wait, I know. Town crier, bomb bailiff, long john, waken the dead, pom, dignum, poor little nominy dominy, pom.
It is music, I mean, of course, it's all pom, 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 very much... what they call da capo.
Still, you can hear. As we march along, pom.
I must really...
Now, if I did that at a banquet,
Just a question of custom, Shah of Persia. Breathe a prayer, drop a tear. All the same, he must have been a bit of a natural, not to see it was a yeoman cap, muffled up. Wonder who was that chap at the grave in the brown mackin? Oh, the whore of the lane. A frowsy whore, with black straw sailor hat askew, came lazily in the day along the quay towards Mr. Bloom. When first he saw that form endearing, yes, it is. I feel so lonely. Wet night in the lane. Horn? Who hath a hee-haw, she-haw? Off her beat here. What is she? Hope she... Psst. Any chance of your wash? New Molly. Had me decked. Stout lady does be with you in the brown costume. Put you off your stroke. That appointment we made. Known me'd never. Well, hardly ever. Too dear. Too near to home, sweet home. Sees me, does she? Looks a fright in the day. Face like dip. Damn her. Oh, well, she has to live like the rest. Look in here. In Lionel Mark's antique sail-shop window, haughty Henry Lionel Leopold, dear Henry Flower, earnestly Mr. Leopold Bloom, envisaged candlestick melodeon, oozing maggoty blowbags, bargain 6 bob. Might learn to play, cheap. Let her pass. Course everything is dear if you don't want it. That's what good salesman is. Make you buy what he wants to sell. Chap sold me the Swedish razor he shaved me with. Wanted to charge me for the edge he gave it. She's passing now. 6 bob. Must be the cider, or perhaps the Bergen. Near bronze from anear, near gold from afar, they chinked their clinking glasses all, bright-eyed and gallant, before bronze Lydia's tempting glass rose of summer, rose of Castile. First Lid, de, cow, ker, doll, a fifth, Lidwell, Cy Dedalus, Bob Cowley, Kernan, and Big Ben Dollard. Tap. A youth entered, a lonely Ormond Hall. Bloom viewed a gallant pictured hero in Lionel Mark's window. Robert Emmet's last words. 7 last words. Of Meyerbeer, that is.
True men like you, men. Aye, aye, Ben, will lift your glass with us.
They lifted. Chink. Chunk. Tip. An unseeing stripling stood in the door. He saw not bronze. He saw not gold. Nor Ben, nor Bob, nor Tom, nor Cy, nor George, nor Tanks, nor Richie, nor Pat. He. He did not see. Sea Bloom, greasy Bloom, viewed last words softly. When my country takes her place among... Must be the Burr... Nations of the earth. No one behind. She's passed. Then, and not till then. Tram. Cran, cran, cran. Good upper. Come in. Crandle, cran, cran. I'm sure it's the Bergen. Yes, 1, 2. Let my epitaph be... Carra! Written. I have... Done.
When my root fire was in my blood, I read of ancient freemen, for Greece and Rome who very stood, the honored men and freemen. And then I prayed I yet might see her fetters rent in twain, and I'll no proven see a nation once again, a nation once again, a nation once again, and I'll unlock a vision see a nation once again.
I was just passing the time of day with old Troy of the DMP at the corner of Arbor Hill there, and be damned, but a bloody sweet came along, and he near drove his gear into me eye. I turned around to let him have the weight of me tongue, when who should I see, dodging along Stony Batter, only Joe Hines. "Lo, Joe," says I, "how are you blowing? Did you see that bloody chimney sweep near shoved me eye out with his brush?" "Such luck," says Joe. "Who's the old bollocks you were talking to?" "Old Troy," says I, "was in the force. I'm in 2 minds not to give that fella in charge for obstructing the thoroughfare with his brooms and lathers." "What are you doing around these parts?" says Joe. "Divil a much," says I. "There's a bloody big foxy thief beyond by the garrison church at the corner of Chicken Lane. Old Troy was just giving me a wrinkle about him. Lifted any god's quantity of tea and sugar to pay 3 bob a week. Said he had a farm in the country. Down off a hop of me thumb by the name of Moses Herzog over there near Haydesbury Street." "Circumcised," says Joe. "Aye," says I, "a bit off the top. An old plumber named Gerrigy. I'm hanging on to his taw now for the past fortnight, and I can't get a penny out of him. "That delay you're on now?" says Joe. "Aye," says I. "How are the mighty fallen, collector of bad and doubtful debts? But that's the most notorious bloody robber you'd meet in a day's walk, and the face on him, all pockmarks, would hold a shower of rain. Tell him," says he, "I dare him," says he, "and I double dare him to send you round here again. Or if he does," says he, "I'll have him summonsed up before the court, so will I, for trading without a licence." And he after stuffing himself till he's fit to burst. Jesus, I had to laugh at the little Dewey getting his shirt out. "He drink me my teas, he eat me my sugars, because he no pay me my monies."
For non-perishable goods, bought of Moses Herzog of 13th St. Kevin's Parade, Wood Quay Ward, merchant, hereinafter called the vendor, and sold and delivered to Michael E. Geraghty, Esquire, of 29 Arbor Hill, in the city of Dublin, Aaron Quay Ward, gentleman, hereinafter called the purchaser, Vidaly said £5 avoirdupois of first choice tea at 3 shillings per pound avoirdupois and 3 stone avoirdupois of sugar, crushed crystal, at 3 pence per pound avoirdupois. The said purchaser, debtor to the said vendor, of £1, 5 shillings and 6 pence sterling for value received, which amount shall be paid by said purchaser to said vendor in weekly instalments every 7 calendar days, of 3 shillings and no pence sterling, and the said non-perishable goods shall not be pawned or pledged or sold or otherwise alienated by the said purchaser, but shall be and remain and be held to be the sole and exclusive property of the said vendor, to be disposed of at his good will and pleasure, until the said amount shall have been duly paid by the said purchaser to the said vendor, in the manner herein set forth, as this day hereby agreed, between the said vendor, his heirs, successors, trustees, and assigns of the one part, and the said purchaser, his heirs, successors, trustees, and assigns of the other part.
"Are you a strict TT?" says Joe. "Not taking anything between drinks," says I. "What about paying our respects to our friend?" says Joe. "Who?" says I. "Sure, he's in John of God's. Off his head, poor man. Drinking his own stuff," says Joe. "Aye," says I. "Whiskey and water on the brain."
"Come around to Barney Kiernan," says Joe.
"I want to see the citizen." "Barney Mavornian's be it," says I. "Anything strange or wonderful, Joe?" "Not a word," says Joe. "I was up at that meeting in the City Arms."
"What was that, Joe?" says I.
"Cattle traders," says Joe, "about the foot and mouth disease. I want to give the citizen the hard word about it." So we went around by the Linen Hall barracks and the back of the courthouse, talking of one thing or another. "Decent fella, Joe, when he has it, but you're like that, he never has it. Jesus, I couldn't get over that bloody Foxy Geraghty, the daylight robber, for trading without a license, is he?"
In Innisfail, the fair, there lies a land, the land of Holy Mitchin. There rises a watchtower, beheld of men afar. There sleep the mighty dead, as in life they slept, warriors and princes of high renown. A pleasant land it is, in sooth, of murmuring waters, fishful streams, where sport the gunnard, the plaice, the roach, the halibut, the jibbed haddock, the grilse, the dab, the brill, the flounder, the mixed coarse fish generally, and other denizens of the aqueous kingdom, too numerous to be enumerated. In the mild breezes of the west and of the east, the lofty trees wave in different directions their first-class foliage. The wafty sycamore, the Lebanonian cedar, the exalted plane tree, the eugenic eucalyptus, and other ornaments of the arboreal world, with which the region is thoroughly well supplied. Lovely maidens sit in close proximity to the roots of the lovely trees, singing the most lovely songs, while they play with all kinds of lovely objects, as for example golden ingots, silvery fishes, crans of herrings, draughts of eels, codlings, creels of fingerlings, purple sea gems, and playful insects. And heroes voyage from afar to woo them, from Ablana to Sleave Margie, the peerless princes of unfettered Munster, and of Connacht the Just, and of smooth, sleek Leinster, and of Cruachan's Land, and of Armagh the Splendid, and of the noble district of Boyle, princes the sons of kings. And there rises a shining palace, whose crystal glittering roof is seen by mariners who traverse the extensive sea in barks built expressly for that purpose, and thither come all herds and fatlings and first-fruits of that land, for O'Connell Fitzsimon takes toll of them, a chieftain descended from chieftains. Thither the extremely large wains bring foison of the fields,
flaskets of cauliflowers, floats of spinach, pineapple chunks, rangoon beans, strikes of tomatoes, drums of figs, drills of swedes, spherical potatoes, and tallies of iridescent kale, York and Savoy, and trays of onions, pearls of the earth, and punnets of mushrooms, and custard marrows, and fat vetches, and bear, and rape, and red-green, yellow-brown, russet-sweet, big, bitter, ripe, pomelated apples, and chips of strawberries, and sieves of gooseberries, pulpy and pelurious, and strawberries fit for princes, and raspberries from their canes.
"I dare him," says he, "and I double dare him. Come out here, Garrity, you notorious bloody hill and dale robber."
And by that way wend the herds innumerable of bellwethers and flushed ewes and shearling rams and lambs and stubble geese and medium steers and roaring mares and polled calves and long wools and store sheep and cuffs prime springers and culls and sow pigs and bacon hogs and the various different varieties of highly distinguished swine, and Angus heifers, and Polly bullocks of immaculate pedigree, together with prime premiated milch cows and beeves. And there is ever heard a trampling, cackling, roaring, lowing, bleating, bellowing, rumbling, grunting, champing, chewing of sheep and pigs and heavy-hoofed kine from pasture lands of lush and rush and carrick mines, and from the streamy vales of Thomond, from McGillicuddy's reeks the inaccessible, and lordly Shannon the unfathomable, and from the gentle declivities of the place of the race of Keir, their udders distended with superabundance of milk, and butts of butter, and rennets of cheese, and farmers' firkins, and targets of lamb, and crannocks of corn, and oblong eggs, in great hundreds, various in size, the agate with the dun.
So we turned into Barney Kiernan's, and there, sure enough, was the citizen up in the corner, having a great confab with himself and that bloody mangy mongrel, Gary Owen, and he waiting for what the sky would drop in the way of drink. There he is, his eye in his glory hole with his crushed keen lawn and his load of papers, working for the cause.
The bloody mongrel let a grouse out of him, would give you the creeps.
Be a capital work of mercy if someone would take the life of that bloody dog.
I'm told for a fact he ate a good part of the breeches off a constabulary man in Santry that came round one time with a blue paper about a license.
"Stand and deliver," says he. "That's all right, citizen," says Joe. "Friends here. Pass, friends," says he. Then he rubs his hand in his eye and says he, "What's your opinion of the times?"
Doing the rapparee and Rory of the Hill.
But begob, Joe was equal to the occasion. "I think the markets are on a rise," says he, sliding his hand down his fork. So begob, the citizen claps his paw on his knee and he says, "Foreign wars is the cause of it." And says Joe, sticking his thumb in his pocket, "It's the Russians wish to tyrannise." "Arra, give over your bloody cotton, Joe," says I. "I've a thirst on me. I wouldn't sell for half a crown." "Give it a name, citizen," says Joe. "Wine of the country," says he. "What's yours?" says Joe. "Ditto, Macanaspi," says I. "3 points, Terry," says Joe. "And how's the old heart, citizen?" says he. "Never better, O'Cora," says he. "What, Gary? Are we going to win, eh?" And with that he took the bloody old towser by the scruff of the neck, and be Jesus, he near throttled him.
The figure seated on a large boulder at the foot of a round tower was that of a broad-shouldered, deep-chested, strong-limbed, frank-eyed, red-haired, freely freckled, shaggy-bearded, wide-mouthed, large-nosed, long-headed, deep-voiced, bare-kneed, brawny-handed, hairy-legged, ruddy-faced, sinewy-armed hero. From shoulder to shoulder he measured several ells, and his rock-like mountainous knees were covered, as was likewise the rest of his body, wherever visible, with a strong growth of tawny, prickly hair, in hue and toughness similar to the mountain gorse, Ulex europus. The wide-winged nostrils, from which bristles of the same tawny hue projected, were of such capaciousness that within their cavernous obscurity the field-lark might easily have lodged her nest. The eyes, in which a tear and a smile strove ever for the mastery, were of the dimensions of a good-sized cauliflower. A powerful current of warm breath issued at regular intervals from the profound cavity of his mouth, while in rhythmic resonance the loud, strong, hale reverberations of his formidable heart thundered rumblingly, causing the ground, the summit of the lofty tower, and the still loftier walls of the cave to vibrate and tremble. He wore a long, unsleeved garment of recently flayed oxhide, reaching to the knees in a loose kilt, and this was bound about his middle by a girdle of plaited straw and rushes. Beneath this he wore trews of deerskin, roughly stitched with gut. His nether extremities were encased in high balbriggan buskins, dyed in lichen purple, the feet being shod with brogues of salted cowhide, laced with the windpipe of the same beast. From his girdle hung a row of sea-stones, which dangled at every movement of his portentous frame, and on these were graven, with rude yet striking art, the tribal images of many Irish heroes and heroines of antiquity, Cuchulainn, Conn of Hundred Battles, Niall of the Nine Hostages, Brian of Kinkora, the Ardrí Malachy, Art McMurrough, Shane O'Neill, Father John Murphy, Owen Rowe, Patrick Sarsfield, Red Hugh O'Donnell, Red Jim McDermott, Sogod Owen O'Growney, Michael Dwyer, Francie Higgins, Henry Joy McCracken, Goliath, Horace Wheatley, Thomas Kenneff, Peg Woffington, The Village Blacksmith, Captain Moonlight, Captain Boycott, Dante Alighieri, Christopher Columbus, St. Fursa, St. Brendan, Marshal McMahon, Charlemagne, Theobald Wolfetone, the Mother of the Maccabees, the Last of the Mohegans, the Rose of Castile, the Man for Galway, the Man that Broke the Bank of Monte Carlo, the Man in the Gap, the Woman Who Didn't, Benjamin Franklin, Napoleon Bonaparte, John L. Sullivan, Cleopatra, Savourneen Dealish, Julius Caesar, Paracelsus, Sir Thomas Lipton, William Tell, Michelangelo, Hayes, Muhammad, the Bride of Lammermoor, Peter the Hermit, Peter the Packer, Dark Rosaline, Patrick W. Shakespeare, Brian Confucius, Martha Gutenberg, Patricio Velasquez, Captain Nemo, Tristan and Isolde, the First Prince of Wales, Thomas Cook and Son, the Bold Soldier Boy, Aaron Apogue, Dick Turpin, Ludwig Beethoven, the Colleen Bawn, Wadler Healy, Angus the Kuldi, Dolly Mount, Sidney Parade, Ben Hoth, Valentine Greatrakes, Adam and Eve, Arthur Wellesley, Boss Croker, Herodotus, Jack the Giant Killer, Gautama Buddha, Lady Godiva, the Lily of Killarney, Balor of the Evil Eye, the Queen of Sheba, Aki Nagel, Joe Nagel, Alessandro Volta, Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa, Don Philip O'Sullivan Bear. A couched spear of acuminated granite rested by him, while at his feet reposed a savage animal of the canine tribe, whose stertorous gasps announced that he was sunk in uneasy slumber, a supposition confirmed by hoarse growls and spasmodic movements which his master repressed from time to time by tranquilizing blows of a mighty cudgel rudely fashioned out of Paleolithic stone. So anyhow, Terry brought the 3 points Joe was standing, and be gob, the sight nearly left me eyes when I saw him land out of quids. I was through, as I'm telling you, a good-looking sovereign. And there's more where that came from, says he. Were you robbing the poor box, Joe, says I. Sweating me brow, says Joe. 'Twas the prudent member gave me the wheeze. I saw him before I met you, says I, sloping around by Pill Lane and Greek Street, with his cod's eye counting up all the guts of the fish. Who comes through Mitchin's land? Bedight in sable armour. O'Bloom, the son of Rory, it is he. Impervious to fear is Rory's son, he of the prudent soul. For the old woman of Prince's Street, says the citizen, the subsidised organ, the pledge-bound party on the floor of the house. And look at this blasted rag, says he. Look at this, says he. The Irish Independent, if you please, founded by Parnell to be the working man's friend. Listen to the births and deaths in the Irish All for Ireland Independent, and I'll thank you. And the marriages. And he starts reading them out. Gordon, Barnfield Crescent, Exeter. Redmayne of Iffley, St. Anne's-on-Sea, the wife of William T. Redmayne, of a son. How's that, eh? Wright and Flint. Vincent and Gillett, to Rotha Marion, daughter of Rosa and the late George Alfred Gillett, 179 Clapham Road, Stockwell. Playwood and Risdale at St. Jude's, Kensington, by the very Reverend Dr. Forrest, Dean of Worcester, eh? Debts, Bristow at Whitehall Lane, London. Carr, Stoke Newington, of gastritis and heart disease. Colborne at the Moat House, Chepstow. I know that fella, says Joe, from bitter experience. Colborne. Dimsey, wife of Davy Dimsey, late of the Admiralty. Miller, Tottenham, aged 85. Welsh, June the 12th, at 35 Canning Street, Liverpool. Isabella, Helen, how's that for a national press, eh, me brown son? How's that for Martin Murphy, the Bantry jobber? Ah, well, says Joe, handing round the booze. Thanks be to God I had the start of his. Drink that, citizen. I will, says he, honourable person. Health, Joe, says I, and all down the farm. And, oh, don't be talking. I was blue mouthy for the want of that point. Declare to God, I could hear it hit the pit of me stomach with a click. And lo, as they quaffed their cup of joy, a godlike messenger came swiftly in, radiant as the eye of heaven, a comely youth, and behind him there passed an elder of noble gait and countenance, bearing the sacred scrolls of law, and with him his lady wife, a dame of peerless lineage, fairest of her race. Little Alf Bergen popped in round the door and hid behind Barney snug, squeezed up with a laughing. And who was sitting up there in the corner that I hadn't seen, snorting drunk, blind to the world, only Bob Dorden.
I didn't know what was up, and Alf kept making signs out of the door. And begob, what was it? Only that bloody old pantaloon Dennis Breen in his bath slippers, with two bloody big books tucked under his ulster, and the wife hot foot after him, unfortunate wretched woman, trotting like a poodle. I thought Alf would split. Look at him, says he. Breen, he's traipsing all around Dublin with a postcard someone sent him with UP up on it to take a lie, and he doubled up. Take a what's his eye? Libel action, says he, for £10,000. Oh, hell, says I. The bloody mongrel began to growl that it put the fear of God in you seeing something was up, but the citizen gave him a kick in the ribs. Be the hushed, says he. Who? Says Joe. Breen, says Alf. He was in John Henry Menton's, and then he went round to Collis and Ward's, and then Tom Rochford met him, and sent him round to the sub-sheriff's for a lark. Oh, God, of a pain laughing. You pee up. The long fella gave him an eye, as good as a process, and now the bloody old lunatic is going round to Green Street to look for a G-man. When is Long John going to hang that fella in Mountjoy? Says Joe. Bergen, says Bob Dorden, waking up. Is that Alf Bergen? Yes, says Alf. Hanging. Wait till I show you. Here, Terry, give us a pony. That bloody hell, Phil. £10,000? You should have seen Long John's eye. You pee? And he started laughing. Who are you laughing at? Says Bob Dorn. Is that Bergen? Hurry up, Terry boy, says Alf. Terence O'Ryan heard him, and straightway brought him a crystal cup full of the foaming ebon ale, which the noble twin brothers, Bon Ivy and Bon Ardalon, brew ever in their divine ale vats, cunning as the sons of deathless leader. For they garner the succulent berries of the hop, and mass and sift and bruise and brew them. And they mix therewith sour juices, and bring the must to the sacred fire, and cease not night or day from their toil, those cunning brothers, lords of the vat. Then did you, chivalrous Terence, hand forth, as to the manner born, that nectarous beverage, and you offer the crystal cup to him that thirsted, the soul of chivalry, in beauty akin to the immortals. But he, the young chief of the O'Bergans, could ill brook to be outdone in generous deeds, but gave therefore with gracious gesture a testoon of costliest bronze. Thereon, embossed an excellent smithwork, was seen the image of a queen of regal port, scion of the House of Brunswick, Victoria her name. Her most excellent majesty, by grace of God, of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, and of the British dominions beyond the sea, queen, defender of the faith, empress of India, even she who bore rule, a victress over many peoples, the well-beloved, for they knew and loved her from the rising of the sun to the going down thereof, the pale, the dark, the ruddy, and the Ethiop. "What's that bloody Freemason doing?" says the citizen, prowling up and down outside. "What's that?" says Joe. "Here you are," says Alf, chucking out the rhino. "Talking about hanging, I'll show you something you never saw. Hangman's letters. Look at here." So he took a bundle of wisps of letters and envelopes out of his pocket. "Are you cotton?" says I. "Honest injun," says Alf. "Read them." So Joe took up the letters. "Who are you laughing at?" says Bob Dorn. So I saw there was going to be a bit of a dust. Bob's a queer chap when the porter's up in him. So, says I, just to make talk, "How's Willie Murray these times, Alf?" "I don't know," says Alf. "I saw him just now in Capel Street with Paddy Dignam. Only I was running after that." "You what?" says Joe, throwing down the letters. "With who?" "With Dignam," says Alf. "Is it Paddy?" says Joe. "Yes," says Alf. "Why?" "Don't you know he's dead?" says Joe. "Paddy Dignam dead?" says Alf. "Aye," says Joe. "Sure, I'm after seeing him not 5 minutes ago," says Alf, "as plain as a pikestaff." "Who's dead?" says Bob Doran. "You saw his ghost then," says Joe, God between us and harm. "What?" says Alf. "Good Christ, only 5. What? And Willie Murray with him, the two of them there, near what do you call him's?" "What? Dignam dead?" "What about Dignam?" says Bob Dorn. "Who's talking about dead?" says Alf. "He's no more dead than you are." "Maybe so," says Joe. "They took the liberty of burying him this morning anyhow." "Paddy?" says Alf. "Aye," says Joe. "He paid the debt of nature. God be merciful to him." "Good Christ," says Alf. "Be gob. He was what you might call flabbergasted." In the darkness, spirit hands were felt to flutter, and when prayer by tantras had been directed to the proper quarter, a faint but increasing luminosity of ruby light became gradually visible, the apparition of the etheric double being particularly lifelike owing to the discharge of jivic rays from the crown of the head and face. Communication was effected to the pituitary body, and also by means of the orange fiery and scarlet rays emanating from the sacral region and solar plexus. Questioned by his earth name as to his whereabouts in the heaven world,
he stated that he was now on the path of pralaya, or return, but was still submitted to trial at the hands of certain bloodthirsty entities on the lower astral levels. In reply to a question as to his first sensations in the great divide beyond, he stated that previously he had seen, as in a glass darkly, but that those who had passed over had summit possibilities of atmic development opened up to them. Interrogated as to whether life there resembled our experience in the flesh, he stated that he had heard from more favored beings, now in the spirit, that their abodes were equipped with every modern home comfort, such as talafana, alavata, hatakalda, water closet, and that the highest adepts were steeped in waves of volupsy of the very purest nature. Having requested a quart of buttermilk, this was brought, and evidently afforded relief. Asked if he had any message for the living, he exhorted all who were still at the wrong side of Maya to acknowledge the true path, for it was reported in Devanic circles that Mars and Jupiter were out for mischief on the eastern angle where the ram has power. It was then queried whether there were any special desires on the part of the defunct, and the reply was, "We greet you, friends of Earth, who are still in the body. Mind CK doesn't pile it on." It was ascertained that the reference was to Mr. Cornelius Kelleher, manager of Messrs. H. J. O'Neill's popular funeral establishment, a personal friend of the defunct, who had been responsible for the carrying out of the internment arrangements. Before departing, he requested that it should be told to his dear son Patsy that the other boot which he had been looking for was at present under the commode in the return room, and that the pair should be sent to Cullen's, to be sold only, as the heels were still good. He stated that this had greatly perturbed his peace of mind in the other region, and earnestly requested that his desire should be made known. Assurances were given that the matter would be attended to, and it was intimated that this had given satisfaction. "He is gone from mortal haunts, O Dignam, son of our mourning. Fleet was his foot on the bracken, Patrick of the beamy brow. Wail, Banba, with your wind, and wail, O ocean, with your whirlwind."
"There he is again," says the citizen, staring out. "Who?" says I. "Bloom," says he. "He's on pint duty up and down there for the last 10 minutes. And begob, I saw his physog do a peep in and then slither off again. Little Alf was knocked ballways. Faith he was. "Good Christ," says he, "I could have sworn it was him." And says Bob Doran, with a hat on the back of his poll, lowest blackguard in Dublin when he's under the influence, "Who said Christ is good? I beg your parsnip," says Alf. "Is that a good Christ," says Bob Doran, "to take away poor little Willie Dignam?" "Ah, well," says Alf, trying to pass it off, "he's over all his troubles." But Bob Doran shouts out of him, "He's a bloody ruffian, I say, to take away poor little Willie Dignam." Terry came down and tipped him the wink to keep quiet, that they didn't want that kind of talk in a respectable licensed premises, and Bob Doran starts doing the weeps about Paddy Dignam Truager there. "The finest man," says he, snivelling, "the finest, purest character." "The tear is bloody near your eye," talking through his bloody hat. "Fitter for him to go home to the little sleepwalking bitch he married, Mooney, the bum bailiff's daughter. Mother kept a kip in Hardwick Street. They used to be stravagin' about the landings. Bantam Lyons told me that was stopping there. At 2 in the morning, without a stitch on her, exposing her person, open to all comers, fair field and no favour. The noblest, the truest," says he. "And he's gone, poor little Willie, poor little Paddy Dignam."
And mournful and with a heavy heart, he bewept the extinction of that beam of heaven. Old Gary Owen started growling again at Bloom, that was skeezing round the door. "Come in, come on, we won't eat you," says the citizen. So Bloom slopes in with his cod's eye on the dog, and he asks Terry, "Was Martin Cunningham there?" "Oh, Christ, McCown," says Joe, reading one of the letters. "Listen to this, will you?" And he starts reading out one. 7 Hunter Street, Liverpool. "To the High Sheriff of Dublin, Dublin. Honoured sir, I beg to offer my services in the above-mentioned painful case. I hanged Joe Gann in Butel Jail on the 12th of February 1900, and I hanged..." "Show us, Joe," says I. "Private Arthur Chase for foul murder of Jesse Tilsit in Pentonville Prison, and I was assisting when..." "Jesus," says I. "Billington executed the awful murderer, Toad Smith." The citizen made a grab at the letter. "Hold hard," says Joe. "I have a special knack of putting the noose once in he can't get out, hoping to be favoured or remain honoured, sir. My terms is 5 guineas, H. Rumbold, Master Barber." "And a barbarous bloody barbarian he is too," says the citizen. "And the dirty scrawl of the wretch," says Joe. "Here," says he, "take them to hell out of my sight, Alf."
"Hello, Bloom," says he. "What'll you have?" So they started arguing about the point, Bloom saying he wouldn't and couldn't and excuse him, no offence and all to that. And then he said, well, he'd just take a cigar. Cobby's a prudent member and no mistake. "Give us one of your prime stinkers, Terry," says Joe. And Alf was telling us there was one chap sent in a mourning card with a black border around it. "They're all barbers," says he, "from the black country, that would hang their own fathers for £5 down and travelling expenses. And he was telling us there's two fellas waiting below to pull his heels down when he gets the drop and choke him properly, and then they chop up the rope after and sell the bits for a few bob a skull." In the dark land they bide, the vengeful knights of the razor. The deadly coil they grasp, yea, and therein they lead to Erebus whatsoever wight hath done a deed of blood. For I will on no wise suffer it, even so, saith the Lord. So they started talking about capital punishment, and of course Bloom comes out with the why and the wherefore and all the codology of the business, and the old dog smelling them all the time. I'm told those Jewies does have a sort of queer odour coming off them for dogs, about I don't know what all deterrent effect and so forth and so on. "There's one thing it hasn't a deterrent effect on," says Alf. "What's that?" says Joe. "The poor bugger's tool that's been hanged," says Alf. "That's so," says Joe. "God's truth," says Alf. "I heard that from the head warder that was in Kilmainham when they hanged Joe Brady, the invincible. He told me when they cut him down after the drop, it was standing up in their faces like a poker." "Ruling passion strong in death," says Joe, as someone said. "That can be explained by science," says Bloom. "It's only a natural phenomenon, don't you see? Because on account of the..." And then he starts with his jawbreakers about phenomenon and science and this phenomenon and the other phenomenon.
The distinguished scientist, Herr Professor Luitpold Blumenduft, tendered medical evidence to the effect that the instantaneous fracture of the cervical vertebrae and consequent scission of the spinal cord would, according to the best approved tradition of medical science, be calculated to inevitably produce in the human subject a violent ganglionic stimulus of the nerve centres, causing the pores of the corpora cavernosa to rapidly dilate, in such a way as to instantaneously facilitate the flow of blood to that part of the human anatomy known as the penis or male organ, resulting in the phenomenon which has been dominated by the faculty, a morbid upwards and outwards philoprogenitive erection, in articulo mortis per diminutionem capitis.
So, of course, the citizen was only waiting for the wink of the word, and he starts gassing out of him about the invincibles and the old guard and the men of 67 and who fears to speak in 98, and Joe with him about all the fellas that were hanged, drawn and transported for the cause by Drumhead Court-Martial and in New Ireland and New this, that and the other. Talking about New Ireland, he ought to go and get a new dog, so he ought. Mangy, ravenous brute, sniffing and sneezing all around the place and scratching his scabs. And round he goes to Bob Doran that was standing out for half one, sucking up for what he could get. So, of course, Bob Doran starts doing the bloody fool with him. "Give us the paw. Give us the paw, doggy. Good old doggy. Give us the paw here. Give us the paw." Ara bloody entered the paw, he'd paw, and out trying to keep him from tumbling off the bloody stool atop of the bloody old dog. And he talking all kinds of drivel about training by kindness and thoroughbred dog and intelligent dog. Give it the bloody pip. Then he starts scraping a few bits of old biscuit out of the bottom of a Jacob's tin he told Terry to bring. Gob, he golloped it down like old boots, and his tongue hanging out of him a yard long for more. Near at the tin and all, hungry bloody mongrel. And the citizen and Bloom having an argument about the point, the brother Shears and Wolf Tom Beyond and Arbor Hill and Robert Emmett and Doyfia Country, the Tommy Moore touch about Sarah Curtin and she's far from the land, and Bloom, of course, with his knock-me-down cigar, putting on swank with his lardy face, phenomenon. The fat heap he married is a nice old phenomenon, with a back on her like a ball alley.
Time they were stopping up in the City Arms, Bishop Work told me. There was an L one there with a cracked leuthram on of a nephew, and Bloom trying to get the soft side of her doing the mollycoddle, playing bezique to come in for a bit of the wampum in her will, and not eating meat on her Friday because the L one was always thumping her craw, and taking the lout out for a walk. And one time he led in the rounds of Dublin, and be the holy farmer, he never cried crackly, brought him home as drunk as a boiled owl. And he said he did it to teach him the evils of alcohol. And by herrings, if the three women didn't near roast him, it's a queer story, the old one, Bloom's wife, and Mrs. O'Dell that kept the hotel. Jesus, I had to laugh a piss of work taking them off, chewing the fat, and Bloom with his, "but don't you see," and "but on the other hand,"
And she'll more be talking. The louse, I'm told, was in Paris after the Blenders round in Cope Street, going home footless in a cab 5 times in the week after drinking his way through all the samples in the bloody establishment. Phenomenon! The memory of the dead, says the citizen, taking up his pint glass and glaring at Bloom. Aye, aye, says Joe.
You don't grasp my point, says Bloom. What I mean is...
Sinn Féin, says the citizen, Sinn Féin a wine. The friends we love are by our side and the foes we hate before us.
The last farewell was affecting in the extreme. From the belfries far and near, the funereal death bell tolled unceasingly, while all around the gloomy precincts rolled the ominous warning of 100 muffled drums, punctuated by the hollow booming of pieces of ordnance. The deafening claps of thunder and the dazzling flashes of lightning which lit up the ghastly scene testified that the artillery of heaven had lent its supernatural pomp to the already gruesome spectacle. A torrential rain poured down from the floodgates of the angry heavens upon the bared heads of the assembled multitude, which numbered at the lowest computation 500,000 persons. A posse of Dublin Metropolitan Police, superintended by the Chief Commissioner in person, maintained order in the vast throng, for whom the York Street Brass and Reed Band whiled away the intervening time, by admirably rendering, on their black-draped instruments, the matchless melody endeared to us from the cradle by Speranza's plaintive muse. Special quick excursion trains and upholstered charabancs had been provided for the comfort of our country cousins, of whom there were large contingents. Considerable amusement was caused by the favourite Dublin street singers, Linen and Mullion, who sang the night before Larry was stretched in their usual mirth-provoking fashion. Our two inimitable drolls did a roaring trade with their broadsheets among lovers of the comedy element, and nobody who has a corner in his heart for real Irish fun, without vulgarity, will grudge them their hard-earned pennies. The children of the male and female founding hospital, who thronged the windows overlooking the scene, were delighted with this unexpected addition to the day's entertainment, and a word of praise is due to the Little Sisters of the Poor for their excellent idea of affording the poor fatherless and motherless children a genuinely instructive treat. The Viceregal House Party, which included many well-known ladies, was chaperoned by their excellencies to the most favourable positions on the grandstand, while the picturesque foreign delegation, known as the Friends of the Emerald Isle, was accommodated on a tribune directly opposite. The delegation, present in full force, consisted of Commendatore Bacci Bacci Benino Benone, the semi-paralysed doyen of the party, who had to be assisted to a seat by the aid of a powerful steam crane, Monsieur Pierre-Paul Petitpatin, the Grand Joker Vladimir Pocket-Handkerchief, the Archjoker Leopold Rudolf von Schwarzenbad Hodenthaler, Countess Marha Varaga Kuzazony Putrafasi, Hiram Y. Bomboost, Count Athanatos Karamalopoulos, Ali Baba Bakshis Rahat Locum Effendi, Senor Hidalgo Caballero Don Peccadillo the Palabras the Paternosta della Malora della Malaria, Hokopoko Harikiri, Hai Hong Chang, Olaf Kober Kettelsen, Mynheer Trik van Trumps, Pan Polax Padiriski, Guspon Prittleser Cratchin' a Britches Itch, Herr Hoorhaus Director President Hans Chuishly Sturley, National Gymnasium, Museum, Sanatorium and Suspensoriums Ordinary Private Docent General History Special Professor Dr. Kriegfried Uberallgemein. All the delegates, without exception, expressed themselves in the strongest possible heterogeneous terms concerning the nameless barbarity which they had been called upon to witness. An animated altercation, in which all took part, ensued among the FOTEI as to whether the 8th or the 9th of March was the correct date of the birth of Ireland's patron saint. In the course of the argument, cannonballs, scimitars, boomerangs, blunderbusses, stink pots, meat choppers, umbrellas, catapults, knuckle dusters, sandbags, lumps of pig iron were resorted to, and blows were freely exchanged. The baby policeman, Constable MacFadden, summoned by special courier from Bootistan, quickly restored order, and with lightning promptitude proposed the 17th of the month as a solution equally honourable for both contending parties. The ready-witted nine-footer suggestion at once appealed to all and was unanimously accepted. Constable MacFadden was heartily congratulated by all the FOTEI, several of whom were bleeding profusely. Commendatore Benino Benone, having been extricated from underneath the presidential armchair, it was explained by his legal adviser, Avvocato Pagamimi, that the various articles secreted in his 32 pockets had been abstracted by him during the affray from the pockets of his junior colleagues in the hope of bringing them to their senses.
The objects, which included several hundred ladies' and gentlemen's gold and silver watches, were promptly restored to their rightful owners, and general harmony reigned supreme. Quietly, unassumingly, Rumbold stepped onto the scaffold in faultless mourning dress, and wearing his favourite flower, the Gladiolus cruentus. He announced his presence by that gentle Rumboldian cough which so many have tried unsuccessfully to imitate, short, painstaking, yet withal so characteristic of the man. The arrival of the world-renowned headsman was greeted by a roar of acclamation from the huge concourse, the vice-regal ladies waving their handkerchiefs in their excitement, while the even more excitable foreign delegates cheered vociferously in a medley of cries, "Hoc! Banzai! Elgen! Vivio! Chin Chin! Polychronia! Hip Hip! Vive! Allah!" amid which the ringing aviva of the delegate of the Land of Song, a high double F recalling those piercingly lovely notes with which the Uno Catalani beglamoured our great-great-grandmothers, was easily distinguishable. It was exactly 17 o'clock. The signal for prayer was then promptly given by megaphone, and in an instant all heads were bared. The commendatore's patriarchal sombrero, which has been in the possession of his family since the revolution of Rienzi, being removed by his medical adviser in attendance, Dr. Pippi. The learned prelate, who administered the last comforts of holy religion to the hero martyr, when about to pay the death penalty, knelt in a most Christian spirit in a pool of rainwater, his cassock above his hoary head, and offered up to the throne of grace fervent prayers of supplication. Hard by the block stood the grim figure of the executioner, his visage being concealed in a 10-gallon pot, with two circular perforated apertures through which his eyes glowered furiously. As he waited the fatal signal, he tested the edge of his horrible weapon by honing it upon his brawny forearm, or decapitated in rapid succession a flock of sheep which had been provided by the admirers of his fell but necessary office. On a handsome mahogany table near him were neatly arranged the quartering knife, the various finely tempered disemboweling appliances, especially supplied by the world-famous firm of cutlers, Messrs. John Round and Sons, Sheffield, a terracotta saucepan for the reception of the duodenum, colon, blind intestine, and appendix, etc., when successfully extracted, and two commodious milk jugs destined to receive the most precious blood of the most precious victim. The house steward of the Amalgamated Cats and Dogs Home was in attendance to convey these vessels, when replenished, to that beneficent institution. Quite an excellent repast, consisting of rashers and eggs, fried steak and onions, done to a nicety, delicious hot breakfast rolls, and invigorating tea, had been considerately provided by the authorities for the consumption of the central figure of the tragedy, who was in capital spirits when prepared for death, and evinced the keenest interest in the proceedings from beginning to end. But he, with an abnegation rare in these our times, rose nobly to the occasion, and expressed the dying wish, immediately acceded to, that the meal should be divided in aliquot parts among the members of the Sick and Indigent Roomkeepers Association as a token of his regard and esteem. The neck and non plus ultra of emotion were reached when the blushing bride-elect burst her way through the serried ranks of the bystanders and flung herself upon the muscular bosom of him who was about to be launched into eternity for her sake. The hero folded her willowy form in a loving embrace, murmuring fondly, "Sheila, my own." Encouraged by this use of her Christian name, she kissed passionately all the various suitable areas of his person which the decencies of prison garb permitted her ardour to reach. She swore to him, as they mingled the salt streams of their tears, that she would cherish his memory, that she would never forget her hero boy who went to his death with a song on his lips as if he were but going to a hurling match in Clonturk Park. She brought back to his recollection the happy days of blissful childhood together on the banks of Analiffy, when they had indulged in the innocent pastimes of the young, and, oblivious of the dreadful present, they both laughed heartily, all the spectators, including the venerable pastor, joining in the general merriment. That monster audience simply rocked with delight. But anon they were overcome with grief and clasped their hands for the last time. A fresh torrent of tears burst from their lacrimal ducts, and the vast concourse of people, touched to the inmost core, broke into heart-rending sobs, not the least affected being the aged prebendary himself. Big, strong men, officers of the peace, and genial giants of the Royal Irish Constabulary were making frank use of their handkerchiefs, and it is safe to say that there was not a dry eye in that record assemblage. A most romantic incident occurred, when a handsome young Oxford graduate, noted for his chivalry towards the fair sex, stepped forward and, presenting his visiting card, bank book, and genealogical tree, solicited the hand of the hapless young lady, requesting her to name the day, and was accepted on the spot. Every lady in the audience was presented with a tasteful souvenir of the occasion, in the shape of a skull and crossbones brooch, a timely and generous act which evoked a fresh outburst of emotion. And when the gallant young Oxonian, the bearer, by the way, of one of the most time-honored names in Albion's history, placed on the finger of his blushing fiancée an expensive engagement ring with emeralds set in the form of a four-leaf shamrock, excitement knew no bounds. Nay, even the stern provost marshal, Lieutenant Colonel Tompkin Maxwell French Mullen Tomlinson, who presided on the sad occasion, he who had blown a considerable number of sepoys from the cannon mouth without flinching, could not now restrain his natural emotion. With his mailed gauntlet, he brushed away a furtive tear, and was overheard by those privileged burghers who happened to be in his immediate entourage to murmur to himself in a faltering undertone, "God blimey, if she ain't a clinker, that there bleedin' tart. Blimey, it makes me kind of bleedin' cry, straight it does, when I sees her, 'cause I thinks of my old mash tub, what's waitin' for me down Limehouse Way." So then the citizens begin talking about the Irish language and the corporation meeting and all to that, and the Shoneens that can't speak their own language, and Joe chipping in because he stuck someone for a quid, and Bloom putting in his old goo with the stumpy stump that he catched off of Joe, and talking about the Gaelic League and the Anti-Treating League and Drink, the Course of Ireland. Anti-Treating is about the size of it. God, he'd let your poor old manner a drink down his throat till the Lord would call him, before you'd ever see the froth of his pint. And one night I went in with the fella into one of their musical evenings, song and dance about she could get up on a truss of hay, she could be Maureen Lay, and there was a fella with a ballyhooly blue ribbon badge spiffing out of him in Irish, and a lot of Colleen Bonds going about with Temperton's beverages and selling medals and oranges and lemonade and a few old Roy buns. Cop, Flahoolock Entertainment, don't be talking. Ireland sober is Ireland free. And then an old fella starts blowing into his bagpipes, and all the gougers shuffling their feet to the tune the old cow died of, and one or two sky pilots having an eye around that there was no goings on with the females, hitting below the belts. So, how and ever, as I was saying, the old dog, seeing the tin was empty, starts mousing around by Joe and me. I'd train him by kindness, though I would, if he was my dog. Give him a rousing fine kick now and again, where it wouldn't blind him. "Afraid he'd bite you," says the citizen, sneering. "No," says I, "but he might take me leg for a lamppost." So he calls the old dog over. "What's on you, Gary?" says he. Then he starts hauling and mauling and talking to him in Irish, and the old towser are growling, letting on to answer, like a duet in the opera. Such growling you never heard, as they let off between them. Someone that has nothing better to do ought to write a letter pro bono publico to the papers about the muzzling order for a dog the like of that. Growling and grousing, and his eye all bloodshot from the drought in it, and the hydrophobia dropping out of his jaws. All those who are interested in the spread of human culture among the lower animals, and their name is Legion, should make a point of not missing the really marvellous exhibition of synanthropy, given by the famous old Irish red wolf dog setter, formerly known by the sobriquet of Gary Owen, and recently rechristened by his large circle of friends and acquaintances, Owen Gary. The exhibition, which is the result of years of training by kindness and a carefully thought-out dietary system, comprises, among other achievements, the recitation of verse. Our greatest living phonetic expert, wild horses shall not drag it from us, has left no stone unturned in his efforts to delucidate and compare the verse recited, and has found it bears a striking resemblance, the italics are ours,